is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, I'm Georgia Hargreaves. It's good to have you here with me for the Country Hour, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app today, thanks to the cricket. Now, very shortly, you'll hear how a group of West Australian grain growers is calling on the state government and CBH to consider reopening the Tier 3 rail line, saying this year's record season proves how much it's needed. And concerns remain high for livestock stuck in floodwaters in parts of northwest Queensland after more heavy falls over the weekend.
After talking to some landholders, you know, one guy yesterday afternoon had flown around and he sort of said after, you know, if he had 2,000 in the paddock, there's probably 300 left.
That's coming up between now and the news at 1 o'clock. 12:06 on the Country Hour, and the analysis around China's decision to impose a 55% tariff on Australian beef exceeding the 205,000-tonne quota continues today. Shortly you'll hear from a New South Wales exporter who believes it will have a detrimental effect on his industry, and others believe Australia has a good track record to survive and even thrive in challenging market conditions. China says the decision was announced to protect its domestic beef industry, but Ben Lyons, a professor of agriculture, climate and environment at the University of Southern Queensland, says it's much more complex.
Well, it's very hard to understand a lot of the motivations because it's quite a convoluted system. But China tries to manage its food trade or its agri-food trade. And this would be sort of, I don't know if it's specifically targeted to Australia because they've got a number of countries like Brazil, Argentina, New Zealand, Uruguay that export beef in a large scale or relatively large volume to China. So
they're all facing a big tariff, but they kick in at different levels. So ours is kicking in just a bit over 200,000 tonnes. I think the Brazilians have got 1.3 mil before they hit a tariff.
Yeah, and they exported to January, November. I think Brazil was about 1.1 million. So we were at looking at 295. So we, you know, if we grandfathered it and look back, we would have been paying 55% for about 90,000 tons. So yeah, so it's another chapter in the saga of Australian-China agricultural trade.
The intention behind though is to protect their own domestic industry. That's what the impression they gave.
They'd be worried about that. They've got this seesaw thing to do because their domestic industry is declining. The old sort of communist sort of data point of going up and to the right every year in the beef industry and in a number of agricultural industries is not the case with China's beef industry because of the opportunity costs in producing beef is too great. So people, a lot of Chinese peasantry have left the beef industry in China. We've seen a lot of aggregation or larger herd sizes to signify that. But also when you see their real census on cattle populations, they have whilst it's sort of generally sort of rising, you see larger farms, so, you know, increasing number of herds of up to 100 head or over 10 head, whereas it used to be a lot of herds of 2 to 3 in size. So in actual fact, they're declining. And despite, you know, a lot of efforts to improve their genetics and look at feedlotting and intensive bovine agriculture in China's sort of had its ups and downs, David. So we might be, you know, they might be on another push to drive up their bovine production. I don't know, or we haven't seen that as yet.
Well, I spoke to a Wagyu producer. He said, look, over a number of years, they were sending heifers, Wagyu heifers, for really good money to China, and that's all dried up now. So what does that say about where they're at, do you reckon?
Well, I would assume, I would make an assumption here that those heifers and that genetics was under a program of, you know, with strong central government and provincial government support, so they would have been subsidised by the government, and I'd say that funding probably ran out. They'd have some successful Wagyu operations over there in a feedlot enterprise, but I'd say that was mainly under, you know, preferential policies or, you know, funding support from a government agency in that region to bring Wagyu genetics in, and that probably ended. It's probably nothing to do with the market, to be honest.
So you were suggesting that actually they're just not very good at producing beef. Is that what you're saying?
They're good at producing beef, but it's had a change. There's a lot of dynamics at play. And one of those key dynamics is the opportunity cost of farming in China vis-a-vis other, you know, ways I could utilise my labour as a person out in the rural on a farm. I'd be better off going into town and work in construction. That's always been for the last 30 years, been a key tension in Chinese agriculture. They have a similar problem to Australia in many ways. It's a shortage of rural labour for agriculture.
Mm. But one of the times that you and I spoke was about their dairy industry, which they had upscaled massively and would seem to be doing well.
Some parts it did well. Some places they had large dairy farms and again went and bought the genetics from Canada and Australia and other countries, but they didn't have the feed infrastructure or the livestock feed. They're a big importer of livestock feed also from Australia, we have to understand. So it's very, you know, China's a big place, a lot of people, as we say, but it's very contested in terms of its land use, and land use is at a premium there, and growing feed for livestock has been a key challenge for them as well.
What's your take on the impact of this decision then? Because though obviously Australia has markets all over the world for our beef. What about the high end? Will it be, because I'm hearing from some producers, well, we'll just sell that, you know, high end Wagyu to another country. We'll be right. But Casino Meat Co-op was saying, oh, look, it's going to cost us $100 million because the Chinese market was lucrative. If I sell it elsewhere, I won't get as much.
The Chinese market's been very good for Australian beef exports on a couple of factors. One is sort of it's diversified. It's a number of different markets within itself. It's got really good carcass utilisation. So, you know, you break a beef down into different cuts, you can sell them all to a Chinese importer or market. So that's where it's been a very good market. But, yeah, I think that producer's sort of half right, or those other, you know, we saw it with barley during the early days of COVID. Australia's of a size where, whilst we're a significant exporter, we're not a behemoth in terms of agricultural production, and we can find other markets relatively quickly, albeit at a bit of a loss. You know, if you talk about barley production as an example, we did lose the Chinese market, and that cost producers some money. So there is a cost.
Ben Lyons, he's a Professor of Agriculture, Climate and Environment at the University of Southern Queensland. He was speaking to David Claughton. And I want to know, if you're a WA-based beef producer, or you're involved in the beef industry here in some way, I'm interested to hear what your take is on this situation with China's 55% tariff above a certain quota. Are you concerned about it from a WA perspective? 0448 922 604 is the number if you'd like to send me a text. Or maybe you think the impact will be felt in other parts of the country more so than WA. Let me know your thoughts. 0448 922 604. An Angus beef exporter from the New South Wales Hunter Valley believes China's 55% tariff will have a detrimental effect on his industry. Robert McKenzie is concerned for smaller producers like himself and is calling for a quota system to manage the 205,000 tonnes quota. He exports a container of 26 tonnes of premium cuts to China each month, with a shipment due to leave this week.
They're only a small percentage of our monthly production, but they're still a very important part of our supply chain. Very, very important. We send a certain amount of cuts there that just help us navigate where all of that production of that animal goes. And they take some cuts that aren't as sought after in other markets. So they're definitely an important part of our program.
So what sort of cuts do you send?
Oh, look, we'll send shin shank and tri-tips and just certain cuts that aren't as popular in other markets.
And so what sort of impact do you think this tariff will have on your business?
I think it'll have a big impact on Australian agriculture. I'm worried that a lot of the big processors will flood the market into China with trims, offals and bones, which that will go towards making up that 205,000 metric ton. that quota could be filled come June, July 2026. And if we're moving regular product into our customers in China come, you know, June or July this year, they're not going to be able to absorb that tariff. So we'll then have to reallocate that product into some other markets. Naturally, when we reach out to those other potential customers, they'll be straight away, they'll know that the tariff has taken effect on Australian product, and you know, they'll play a little bit hardball. So we've really got to look at it now. You know, do we look for those other markets beforehand? Or do we wait till the tariff comes into play mid-year? What do we do?
And so if the quota's filled with the cheaper trim, lower-end products, then the Chinese consumer misses out on the Australian premium product. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, as soon as that quota's filled, and whether it's trim, bones, offals or high-end product, whenever that's filled, the consumer's going to miss out on that product. We have to then work out where that product's going to go in other parts of the world. And look, Australian beef is definitely high up on the menu right around the world. So but potentially it might not be hard to move that, but it definitely will come at a cost. There's no doubt about it.
As an exporter, would you try and pass that 55% tariff on to the Chinese consumer? Would they pay that? Is that a consideration?
No, they wouldn't pay it. The Chinese market's very price sensitive now, and they wouldn't be able to absorb that. So there'll be no way that you'd be selling any product into China once that tariff comes into play. So it'll be a little bit of a mess. My thoughts are whether the government and our peak bodies, MLA, Cattle Australia, etc., get together, and whether we look at maybe a quota system. So if you're selling product into China in 2024 and it was X amount of kilos or tonnages, you might be allowed to have that quota for 2026, and then it won't be such a rush to the door. It's just going to be a rush for people to pump that product into China. It'll just go into cold stores, be frozen, and they'll just use it throughout the year. But it's just going to really make us or smaller producers like ourselves manage that supply chain. And also that void when they say, look, we can't take any more. So it's a big decision that we have to make. We're not a big player. We're only a small player, but that market's very important to us.
So if you do keep exporting to China until June when the quota's filled, where do you think you may export to then? What other markets would you might consider?
Well, look, we're sending product into Hong Kong. So it might be Korea. It might be Vietnam. Obviously, it'll be probably for those cuts, it'll be into that Asian market most likely. But then we've also got the problem too is, you know, Brazil and Argentina and all that, when they hit their quota, they'll be looking to flood the market also. Anyway, we'll just have to wait and see, but it is a little bit concerning. It concerns me on how we're going to manage it, how the industry will manage it. And we've worked really hard to build, you know, solid supply chains in China, working with some really, really good people. And they would be scrambling also thinking, well, how are they going to manage come the back end of 2026 also?
Well, we know this is about, you know, protecting local producers in China. Do you know if the industries there are growing their Angus and Wagyu herds?
Yeah, look, that is a really good question. We have been in discussions with some companies in China about sending some of our genetics into China to, you know, help, I suppose, boost the quality of their herd, and whether that's with fertility, with weight gain, but also feed conversion. We're very focused on that within our own operation. So the China farmers or the Chinese agriculture department, they definitely want to make their farmers more profitable and more productive. And we've been in discussions with them about sending genetics into China to help make their herd more productive.
A potential loss to you.
Look, whether they do this or not, it's the tariffs, they're going to come in anyway. So maybe if we can boost up the quality of their herd, they might drop this tariff down the track anyway, because the problem is, you know, a lot of their product isn't meeting that high-end market, and they probably want to make that product meet that market. So, look, if one door closed, another one might open. You never know. But, look, at the end of the day, I think that we can manage this fallout if we get the support from our government and our industry.
Robert McKenzie, he is director of Macca's Australian Black Angus Beef, which is over in New South Wales in the Hunter Valley region. And you heard him there talking to Kim Honan. It's 21 past 12. You're listening to the WA Country Hour on the ABC Listen app. And I've got some sad news for you. Sir Graham McCamley has died at the age of 93. He was known as a modern-day pioneer and champion of Australia's beef industry. From founding the Cattlemen's Union to helping develop the Brahman breed through work with the CSIRO and Queensland University, his influence stretched across agriculture, politics and rural Australia. Brett Coombs was family friends with Sir Graham. And he says he's left behind an incredible legacy.
You know, Graham was an innovator. There's no doubt about that. You know, what he did was just amazing.
How would you describe the legacy that he leaves behind?
Well, I guess, you know, the thing with Graham that always got me with him was, you know, he was always thinking, you know, like you could talk to Graham and, you know, he'd fly, I'd be AI and cows, he'd fly in and ask me how I was going, how many I'd done or whatever. And, you know, he'd look at him and he'd look straight past you, and you know he was thinking about what else he could be doing or whatever. So he was certainly an outside-the-box thinker, and, you know, there's no doubt that the Brigalow development and you know, the use of pivots and irrigation and all that setup that he set up at Tartus and Royals was his foresight, and, you know, the use of choppers, you know, he was a, you know, blade ploughing. I mean, all those things, you know, obviously I'm not saying that Graham developed, but he certainly was an innovator in getting them in there and just getting stuff done. He was amazing like that, yeah.
What can you tell us about his contribution to the breed?
Well, you know, back in the 60s, Graham and his brother Jeff, basically, Jeff had Lancefield and Graham had Tartus, and they started the Tartus Lancefield site, well, and they both had, you know, were certainly big stud breeders then, but they started their sale, and I think it was about 50 years, about 2 years ago. So, you know, that was back in the 70s, I guess, I'm working out the numbers. But unfortunately, the Tartus aren't in that sale anymore. But, you know, there was probably 48 years of, you know, just the Tartus Lancefield sale was a, you know, it was a monumental event every year. You know, you'd go there, they were the ones that started the night sales, and there'd be glitter, and, you know, it was pretty amazing. And certainly Graham and Jeff, his brother, they certainly, you know, were innovators in all that, and they were the guys that, you know, they obviously had cattle in here from the 50s imports, but they were the ones that went over there in the late 70s and imported cattle with a lot of the other pioneers, Rob Innes, and, you know, I don't need to name them all, but there was a lot of fellas that, well, there was a core group of probably 10 breeders that really bought a lot of cattle in the 70s and 80s, and Graham was certainly amongst them. And you know, they certainly showed cattle, and they were big in the performance recording. They did a lot of steer fattening and carcass competitions. And, yeah, he certainly was an innovator. And I guess the one thing I do remember about Graham is he was president of the Brahman Breeders back in the early 70s, and the Beef Depression started in 74. And I can tell you, I was only high, being primary school then, but I do remember, you know, that no sooner had the Beef Depression started, Graham McCamley wasn't going to put up with this low price for beef. I think he opened two butcher shops in Rocky, and he was always thinking outside the box, like I said. And you know, that's where I've got to tip my hat to him. And you know, he developed a great thing at Tartus there. It was an amazing setup. I know they had a big field day there back probably 20 years ago now, but it was, you know, just to see the setup, the you know, and he certainly had some great staff, you know, the Catons and old Frank Titmus, Frank and Pauline, they were there for a long time. And, you know, there were some guys that really stuck by him. And, you know, he ended up with Curtis Island, I think, and, you know, he certainly, he spread his wings. He went up north to Richmond, and some of that irrigation up there he got going, and then he developed Royals, and you know, that was, you know, amazing, all the flood irrigation and the centre pivots and the water harvesting, and yeah, so it was a pretty amazing setup, and what he did in his lifetime was, you know, most of us would be flat-footing it into three lifetimes.
Brett Coombs talking about his friend Sir Graham McCamley, who passed away at aged 93. He was speaking with Jeremy Jones about the legacy of Sir Graham and the influence he had on Australia's beef industry. There is an article online if you'd like to read more about some of the things he did in his life. Just head to the ABC News website and search Tributes and Beef Industry, and you'll find the article there. 26 past 12 on the Country Hour this afternoon, and a group of West Australian grain growers is calling on the state government and CBH to consider reopening the Tier 3 rail line, saying this year's record season proves how much it's needed. The Tier 3 rail network was closed in 2014, forcing more trucks on roads to outload grain from receival sites like Wickapen, Quereting and Narrumbeen. Bob Ifler from Concerned Grower Shareholders of CBH says freight rates are now out of control at some locations, especially in the eastern wheat belt. And he says to save growers' money and lives on the road, Tier 3 rail needs to be back in the mix.
Rail is a very cheap mode of transport. It's also about 17 times more efficient than road transport. And road transport in those areas is not much different to what rail is. So if we look at 17 times more efficient, it's a lot, could be a lot cheaper.
So that being said, you're concerned that Tier 3 isn't going to reopen. I mean, CBH have said that it's not a priority. Are you chasing a bit of a pipe dream that it might?
Well, we could be, but I suppose we've got to start getting rid of directors. I think that's the way, and to change things. We haven't been too successful before, but the state government's also talking about opening Tier 3. And when you think about rail, that's there for a long time once it's up and running. Now, these windmills they're putting up everywhere, you know, they might be okay, but why not put the money into rail?
The rail routes on Tier 3 have been said to not be viable. So if there was money put into those routes to reopen them, do you not think that maybe some of those costs would be absorbed by other routes and everybody's freight rates would increase again across the network?
Yeah, well, something's got to be done about the access fee being 4 to 5 times as high as the eastern states, and then it makes all things work. So something's got to be done. The state government needs to step in here as well. It's not just CBH that need to lift their game.
In an ideal world, what would you like to see happen?
Well, just open a few of the priority lines. Maybe the line from Coolin up to Meriden, the Wickapen line maybe, or something like that. Just a couple of lines, which then they could cart a lot of stuff too. At the moment, Tara, they're carting backwards. They're carting backwards, and, you know, the other day there was a serious accident along that road, and it's costing $7, I think $7 odd a tonne to take it back from Brookton Way, and so it's going to take $7 to get it back to Brookton. So it's another cost they're doing. I mean, I don't think they're reading the play very well.
So you're saying that grain's being double-handled and moved further away from port, Bob? What rationale do you think's behind that?
That's your comment, yeah. Well, I guess when they have a good season, bins fill up fairly quickly. And York is actually the place. York's 1827 and Mawson is 2543. So if you cart it back, that's carting it back east instead of to the port. You're paying another $7.16 a tonne more. And, of course, it's got to be carted back. So it's another $7.16, which makes $14.
Do you feel like big seasons like we're seeing this year, do you think it really demonstrates some of those areas that are lacking?
Yeah, it always does. You know, doesn't matter what it is, whether you have too much rain at seeding time or whatever, it shows you some inefficiencies. And this would be the same with a huge crop. There would be some inefficiencies. You have to expect some, but not so many.
Bob Ifler from Concerned Grower Shareholders of CBH. He was speaking with Tara de Landgraft. And we have put in a request into Transport Minister Rita Saffiotti's office to see if the state government will actually reconsider opening the Tier 3 railway line to reduce the number of grain trucks on the road. We will keep you updated and let you know when we get a response. It's 12:30, time for an update from the newsroom. Charlie Mills is here today in Karratha. Charlie, what's making headlines today?
G'day, Georgia. US President Donald Trump has threatened military action against Colombia's government after attacking Venezuela's capital and capturing the country's leader. Federal opposition leader Susan Lee says it's too little too late from the Prime Minister, who is expected to recall Parliament early to push through gun reform and strengthen laws on hate speech. And a Monash University-led study has found evidence of memory and learning changes among women who experience repeated head hits and strangulation due to intimate partner violence. More news coming up, Georgia, at 1 p.m.
Thank you, Charlie. It is 29 to 1. You're listening to the WA Country Hour on the ABC Listen app. Now, just before the next headlines at 1 o'clock, Terry Birkin will run you through the results of the first Mushay cattle sale of the year. Right now, though, off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Angeline Prasad is here today. Let's start in the Southwest Land Division. Angeline, what can we expect?
Good afternoon, Georgia. Well, we have got fairly hot conditions across the Southwest Land Division still persisting. Starting to see a bit of a milder change develop on the West Coast, but still quite hot through inland parts. Today we have got the inland trough moving a little bit further east, so not expecting any thunderstorms. But tomorrow it is possible that we may see the isolated thunderstorm return, especially through the eastern parts of the central wheat belt, so east of about Meriden. So these thunderstorms are likely to be dry. There's also a risk of damaging wind gusts briefly tomorrow with these dry thunderstorms. And of course, when we say dry thunderstorms, there's usually very little rainfall associated with these thunderstorms. So that dry lightning may cause wildfire ignition in the landscape. So the main risk tomorrow is the eastern parts of the central wheat belt, maybe extending to the far northeast of the Great Southern, so east of Hyden. The trough does move further inland into the goldfields and the interior on Wednesday, so that risk of thunderstorm does ease off for a couple of days heading into the second half of the week. Now, the very hot temperatures that I have been talking about, daytime temperatures getting into the high 30s to low 30s, will also gradually contract out of the Southwest Land Division. It's going to take a couple of days, so we do expect those very hot conditions to linger for a couple more days. But from Wednesday onwards, we will see a milder change extend through through the entire Southwest Land Division. Initially, it's going to be along the southern districts, but then gradually extend throughout. So we have got a severe heat wave warning current for the central wheat belt. So another couple of days of heat before that heat moves away, and we do see a milder change extend across much of the Southwest Land Division. The milder change is going to last until the weekend. So later this weekend, especially from Sunday onwards, we'll see the West Coast trough return, and that's going to bring in those very hot temperatures again. Now, with that ridge developing, that is going to bring in a milder change. It is also going to bring in a windy change, so it will feel quite breezy, especially in the second half of the week. So quite moderate to fresh winds extending from the southeast. So yes, we do see the milder change come through, but it will get quite breezy for a couple of days until we see the West Coast trough return.
And what's on the radar in the northern and eastern forecast districts?
Well, the thunderstorms I have mentioned are mainly dry thunderstorms will affect the Gascoyne, the goldfields, and extend into the Eucla and interior for the next couple of days. They do contract northwards on Saturday with that the ridge becoming firmly established across southern WA, but these thunderstorms will likely persist for the next few days through the districts I have mentioned. And again, not much rainfall with them, the risk of lightning, but also the risk of damaging wind gusts. So wind gusts getting up to that 90 kilometers per hour. So these thunderstorms that do occur will be quite gusty, quite isolated. And then the heat will also persist through this area. So we have seen a fairly prolonged hot to very hot spell. It's been persisting for a few days and it is going to persist for a few more days. So that heat wave warning will likely persist until later in the week. So severe heat wave currently persisting through these districts I have mentioned. We're likely to see temperatures ease, but it's not going to happen until probably Thursday or Friday when that ridge across southern WA does bring a milder change to much of these districts in southern and central WA. Moving further north, we're expecting thunderstorms generally on the seasonal side, so the Pilbara area. Again, not much rainfall, quite gusty, and there is that risk of damaging wind gusts from the thunderstorms, mainly through inland parts of the Pilbara, and then they're likely to continue throughout the week. Thunderstorms are a little bit more moist through the Kimberley, so especially northern parts of the Kimberley, we'll get some rainfall, but especially across southern Kimberley, the thunderstorms will be quite gusty and maybe a little bit more rainfall. Apart from that, the heat wave is persisting through the northern parts of the state as well. Later in the week, we will see temperatures drop a few degrees, so getting from dropping from the mid-40s during the day to the low 40s, maybe 40, maybe into the high 30s. And that will help bring some respite from the heat wave conditions.
And just very quickly, Ange, what is the latest with that tropical low that passed the Cocos Islands today?
So it's currently located about 90 kilometres to the northeast of Cocos Island. It is slowly developing and intensifying, so we may be able to name it during the afternoon period. So it is on the way to becoming a tropical cyclone. And over the next few hours over the Cocos Islands, we could see some damaging wind gusts, also quite heavy rainfall associated with the tropical developing tropical low, and a bit of storm inundation, especially in the lagoon with the high tide early this evening.
Thank you, Angeline, for the update. It is 23 to 1. Now, in terms of rainfall in WA in the last 72 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, most of it was in the north. So in the Kimberley, Broome Airport, 23, Charnley River, 28, Country Downs, 7, Curtin Arrow, 20, Signet Bay, 5, Debisa, 9, Diggers Rest, 18, Doongan, 51, Ellenbrae, 7, Faraway Bay, 11, Gibb River, 8, Kashana, 20, Kalumburu, 43, Kilto Station, 27, Kununurra Aero, 5, Kununurra Checkpoint, 46, Kununurra, 18, Lansdowne, 6, Leopold Downs, 30, Liveringa Station, 9, Moolaboola Airstrip, 7, Mount Barnett, 39, Mount House Airstrip, 12, Mount Winifred, 6, Theda, 54, Troughton Island, 12, Truscott, 18, Udialla, 5, and Wingina Gorge, 26, and nothing over 5 millimetres in the southwest land division. And due to the risk of fire today, there is a total fire ban in place for the local government area of Exmouth. So remember, during a total fire ban, you can't have any activity that could start a fire. So that includes things like having outdoor fires, carrying out hot work like grinding, welding and gas cutting, and going off-road four-wheel driving. But remember, there's a full list on the Emergency WA website if you're not sure, so make sure you check that. And it's also your responsibility to check with your local government if there's a harvest and vehicle movement ban. So just to repeat, there is a total fire ban today for the local government area of Exmouth. Now, as much needed sun starts to make an appearance across sodden parts of northwest Queensland, concerns remain high for livestock stuck in floodwaters. Prior to the weekend, the area around Richmond was faring okay, according to Mayor John Wharton, but isolated and heavy rain saw falls of up to 200 mils across the area. He spoke with Madeline McCosker earlier this morning about how the region is faring.
Well, we got smashed night before last, and but we've had, the rain has cleared this morning, and we've had a beautiful day coming ahead of us. We're full on with resupply and dropping hay today with helicopters, but we can only do a little bit over the last 3 or 4 days because the weather came in and out and rained, and we don't like to fly them in the rain. So when we got a break, we were flat out. There's probably 8 or 10 helicopters out there at the airport. They'll be geared up and they'll be real busy today. We're not sure how it's going to go now. That last rain we got the night before last night was very, very heavy rain, and we think that it's probably killed a lot of cattle now. We're very wary about dropping hay out in the black soil where it's very soggy. We only want to drop hay on ridges and harder country. And when you've got those ridges and harder country, there's probably going to be a pick that those cattle can eat. We have had information that one landowner, he's flown around his cattle and they've spread out because it's dried out enough. He missed out on a couple of storms, and he said his cattle are good. He's quite happy with his, but others, when they had that 200 mils, it just broke the camel's back, really. So, you know, they were okay before, and we were really good, honestly. Richmond and the Flinders Shire were really good up until that last night, and that sort of broke the camel's back, all right. Yeah. Killed a lot of cattle.
Do you have any, is it too early at this stage still to know figures in terms of cattle losses?
Yeah. I think after talking to some landholders, you know, one guy yesterday afternoon had flown around, and he sort of said after, you know, if he had 2,000 in the paddock, there's probably 300 left.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, no, that's pretty bad. And there's big losses up in the Gulf again, you know. We revisited the old 19 again. A lot of cattle are gone, and mainly because those big storms, those big falls, you know, that 100 mil, 200 mil falls. You know, as I said the other day on an interview, that 50 mils or 60 mils out here is like 160 mils on the coast. The effect it has, like on the coast, that big rain on the coast, talked to those fellas on the coast and they said, oh, that's nothing, we're used to that, it just runs straight off into the ocean. But you get 60 mils out here after you've had a couple of 100 mils, and by George, it really does do a lot of damage. So can't get away, you know.
John Wharton, he's mayor of the Richmond Shire, which is over in northwest Queensland. He was speaking with Madeline McCosker. And so far, it looks like the number of missing or deceased stock in northwest Queensland is around 16,530. That's according to figures released this morning by Queensland's Department of Primary Industries. 17 to 1 on the country hour this afternoon. And the Northern Territory mango harvest has finished up, but fruit is still coming off the trees here in WA and over in Queensland, where the harvest has been slightly delayed by rain. Here's Australian Mango's CEO, Trevor Dunmore, talking about how the season is shaping up in the new year across the country.
Queensland growers are still in the middle of picking, and also some of our growers in Carnarvon in Western Australia. So, Still, the season continues, and the Queensland, North Queensland's, as you're probably aware, is being in a fair bit of rain. So, I think that's held up growers a little bit, but you know, I think the harvest is still proceeding. As far as you know, Northern Territory growers, I think they've had a reasonable season. They've had the last few seasons have been fairly tough for many of the growers in the north. This season a little bit better, but you know, we're still. Growers were always looking for better returns. So, hopefully this year Darwin and Territory growers will get a good start of a wet season. That will continue, and then we get a good dry season through, you know, through from April through to September.
Are there policy or advocacy positions that you'll be considering in the new year?
The big ones for us are, and continuing, is our battle to get our compliance systems into a place where logic is more important than bureaucracy. The food safety and ethical employment of staff and workers is really critical and really important, but the red tape and bureaucracy have overtaken logic, and so that's one of our key areas. The palm scheme certainly has been very good for growers who use palm workers. It's a really great system, but again, bureaucracy and some of the rules and regulations are making the scheme unworkable for some growers. So those are the areas that continue to need further work, not just for mangoes, but for horticulture in general.
You did mention before the weather in Queensland. There's a TV on in the studio here with the ABC banner, livestock losses expected from flooding in northwest Queensland. Has there been impact on the mango sector due to this weather?
From our understanding, I haven't spoken to any growers in the last couple of days, but they haven't had the in the Mareeba Dimbula area, they've had some rain, but not to the extent that northwestern Queensland has had. And obviously our hearts go out to those growers and graziers and, you know, potential stock losses. So that's obviously very devastating for them. Our growers, I think, at this stage, it's just, you know, harvest has been delayed, but it's still continuing in between showers. Our next concern is that, you know, there have been some transport disruptions because of, you know, some flooding of roads, but I think that's only been a minor disruption at this stage. We'll have to wait to see over the next few days what happens.
And a brief word on the harvest in WA and Carnarvon. How's that going?
Some growers started before Christmas, but, you know, a fair few growers only started usually, you know, their traditional start is Boxing Day. We were over there in early December. They had the growers in general had a good crop and very clean fruit, so, and they've had pretty good conditions through December and now up to now. So I'm expecting their harvest is going well with, you know, and really good quality fruit going into mainly Perth markets.
Australian Mango's CEO Trevor Dunmull, he was speaking to Tom Robinson. And it may not always feel like it, but harvesting grain is probably a lot easier these days than it was a century ago. That's something South Australian farmer Lee Baker knows all too well. Lee is an avid collector of old machinery, and this harvest, he put a 95-year-old Sunshine Auto header to work. His grandfather bought the machine back in 1950 before Lee bought it off him in the late 70s. And while he may not know how often it was used, he has heard stories about it from his father.
I remember Dad telling me they got it stuck in a foxhole when they had steel wheels on it, and then after they got it stuck, they pulled it out and they got a local engineering mob at Yorktown put rubber tyres on it.
And so why did you want to buy it?
I just like old things, and I thought that's the only sentimental thing that I was going to get from the family.
And what kind of quality was it in when you got it?
Didn't go, I towed it home, and then I brought it back here and put it in our shed, and then I drug it out about approximately 30 40 years later. When I had a triple bypass, I lost all motive in life, and I thought, well, I'd do something. I got that out, freed it all up, the knife was seized, probably had a wheelbarrow load of rat manure in the thrasher. The thrasher was seized, there was sheep skin parts all through it, and then I bought a new set of plugs and got my cousin to make a new exhaust, and we towed it probably 10 metres and it started. And it starts reasonably good now. And we bought a new header this year, my son did, so I just wanted to put a comparison between the new one and the old one to say that the old still can do the job.
So you took it out a couple of weeks ago. Was that the first time you've had it out working?
Well, I had it out 4 years ago, but only did a little bit that time just to get it going. Then we put it in the shed and then, yeah, I thought I'd get it out this year. And all I wanted was a photo next to the new ones, next to the old one, so I can put it on the wall.
And how did it run out in the paddock?
It ran quite well, actually. Well, it ran out of petrol once, because I only had the little tank full of petrol. I didn't, because it runs on kerosene. I haven't got kerosene, so filled the little tank of petrol up. We went, and then it ran out, so I put some more in it, and then we got it going again and did a bit more. It did get fairly hot. I suppose it was a warm day, but I suppose we're not used to sitting so close to the motor. Nowadays, we're just used to sitting in air-conditioned cabin luxury. And GPS, whereas this takes a little bit to steer it and to work out how to use the header. Like, you need to start probably 10 metres before you actually get to the crop. You need to put, because it's only got one clutch, so you need to put the header in gear and the drive gear in gear at the same time. So you need to hit the crop at full speed with the header going. So that took a little bit to get used to how to work that one out.
What else is different from this compared to the new stuff?
I suppose the air-conditioned cab and auto-steer, I suppose. I couldn't get the young ones to drive it.
What's the process?
It holds approximately 3 to 4 bags, the little box, and then you have somebody on the side which bags it off, and then I think it holds 10 or 11 bags on the bagging platform. Then when you fill that, you go over and you put all the bags together and someone sews the bags up.
How many did you get when you took it out?
Oh, we only did 2 or 3 bags.
How long did that take?
Probably, I don't know, we're out there mucking around for an hour by the time we got it worked out how to work it. I want to get it out in 5 years' time when it's 100 years old. I'm going to play with it a bit more and get the rust out of it more, and now that I'm starting to get used to how to work it. It has got an instruction book, but I should have read that first, I suppose.
I think it's pretty normal for a farmer not to read an instruction book, from what I know.
I think you're right there. I don't think you'd get parts for it anymore, unless you find an old one that's wrecked to get the parts off it.
And in terms of the front, how does it cut compared to the new stuff?
Well, this is like a comb front, the old style. And the new ones are all open front, so they don't block up as much. They're open front, the new ones, whereas these seem to block up if you've got turnip or rubbish in your crop as well. You'll have more trouble with these feeding than what the new ones. But I suppose when you look at it, they're basically the same principle. It cuts it off, goes up into the thrasher and thrash it, and then it goes through over the walkers. Whereas this has got walkers, the new ones don't have walkers. Yeah, I like playing with old stuff, and I just like mucking around with it. I've always liked old stuff.
Lee Baker farms at Wild Horse Plains, which is 75 kilometres north of Adelaide. He was talking to Isabella Kelly about some of his vintage farm machinery. One of those headers he has is 95 years old. Wow. 8 to 1 on the Country Hour, and a new program to help tackle the impacts of climate change on the wine industry is rolling out across the Southwest and Great Southern. The Wine Forward Climate Resilience Program, led by Wines of WA, will involve developing climate risk assessments, carbon footprint measurements, and adaptation planning. Sustainability and Industry Program Manager Eloise Jarvis says the program is about understanding how climate change affects growing conditions, but also the business side of things.
The Wine Forward Climate Resilience Program in particular focuses on enabling businesses to do climate risk assessment and carbon footprint measurements with adaptation planning. And the program came about because there's a wonderful young woman down in Albany, Isadora Bianchi. She had good friends in the wine industry and recognised an issue around there was little available tools to enable them to do their own climate risk assessments with climate change happening and how a business can adapt and modify to meet those changes. Because I guess if we're going to be realistic about this, climate change has happened. And we need to now work on how we're going to adapt and thrive and become resilient in that process.
If producers get involved with the Wine Forward Climate Resilience Program, what practically will they be doing as part of those climate risk assessments for their businesses?
With Isadora, they will be drilling down into all facets of their business. So they will be looking not only at how they manage their vineyards and operate and the carbon footprint of that those activities on ground in terms of, you know, basic things like how many tractor passes do you do up and down your rows and what fuel is used in that and what are the carbon emissions related to that, right across through to fertilizer use, through to energy use, and then in the winery, similar sort of things. But then it'll also come back to the business and drill down into the business side of it and look at where there might be gaps in understanding and knowledge and build that space too. So within this really key is carbon footprint measurements of scope 1, 2, and 3. And at the moment, we don't have really easily accessible carbon emissions calculators that cover scope 3. And for the wine industry, scope 3 represents all those things that you purchase, such as your packaging. It also includes your freight. And I guess all of those things that are out of your control in terms of their own carbon emissions, but you absorb them into your business because you need those services and those products to bottle your wine in or send your wine off over to different markets. And so this will provide an affordable, easily accessible, easy to understand tool in that space. And with that carbon footprint data, it can give them market access and room to be able to leverage that, but also insights into how they can reduce that.
From a growing perspective, for obvious reasons, there's a need to change, or there's a need to adapt to changing weather conditions. But what about beyond the vineyard? What implications does climate change have on things like supply chains, costs, regulations, market expectations, you know, all the business side of things?
A huge amount. In fact, I think that's probably the most significant sort of issue that we're going to be faced with. You know, the environmental elements, not easy to address, but I think they're kind of more clearly understood by our wine producers and grape growers. What I don't necessarily think is understood is the regulations that are coming and in place already around the federal government wants to have carbon emissions reporting. And at the moment, they're focusing on very large businesses that have a gross profit of $500 million. But that's very quickly going to come down to those businesses that have profits of $50 million. And that means that a lot of our businesses that we supply to in our domestic market as well as our export market are going to need to report on their emissions, and we become one of their scope threes. And so when we can provide them with a figure of what our emissions are, then that brings value to them. And then when we can also demonstrate that we are taking measurable steps towards reducing those carbon footprint measurements, then that actually puts us ahead of our competitors within the same market and hopefully gives us access to greater markets and stability in that because of those measures that we're taking in terms of, you know, business management and practice management. And I think it's that market access also around potentially enabling you to have insurance or not have insurance, because if an insurer can see that you're taking genuine actions towards being resilient and adaptive around climate change, then that may influence what your premiums look like, along with sort of bank loans. So I think all of these things have long-term ramifications for businesses in that level of economics and finance and accountability.
Wines of WA Sustainability and Industry Program Manager Eloise Jarvis speaking with Amelia Searson. Now, 909 cattle were yarded for sale today at the first Mouchet cattle market for 2026. That figure is down on the last sale by 603. Terry Birkin, how was the first day back?
The first sale for the year had moderate numbers, with large lines of cows, grown heifers and yearling heifers being the highlight of the sale. The remainder of the sale was made up of several good runs of weaners and tail and pastoral calves, with very few bulls available. Values remain consistent with the previous market, with weaner steers reaching 470 cents and cows selling up to 338 cents a kilo. Local weaner steers were selling from 356 to 470 cents, while weaner heifers were making 220 to 378 cents a kilo. Most local yearling steers were over 330 kg, selling from 366 to 450 cents, Well, yearling heifers under 330 kg range from 180 cents to 350 cents, and with more weight and frame, sold up to 386 cents a kilo. Pastoral steer calves started from 244 cents up to 412 cents, and pastoral heifers from 180 cents to 360 cents, all quality dependent. The very limited number of grown steers made 272 to 370 cents, while grown heifers returned 300 to 376 cents a kilo. Store cows range from 150 to 280 cents, medium cows from 290 to 320, and heavy cows sold to a top of 338 cents a kilo. Young bulls were very limited in supply, and the best of them realised 372 cents, while heavy bulls, also scarce, sold from 300 to 334 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that, Terry. And this week, things are starting to get back to normal in terms of livestock sales. So Terry Birkin will be back with us tomorrow for this year's first Mouchay sheep sale. So we'll run you through those results. And that's all we have time for on the Country Hour this afternoon. Thanks for tuning in on the ABC Listen app. It's time for the news, 1 o'clock.